From CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. This week, we're revisiting some of our best conversations on Insight as we round out the year. In the political world, some big seats opened up this year and a lot of firsts. Attorney General Javier Becerra left for the Biden administration, becoming the Health and Human Services Secretary. Assemblymember Rob Bonta filled that post, becoming the first Filipino-American Attorney General in California. And Senator Kamala Harris, well, you know where she went. Taking over the Vice President's Senate seat is Senator Alex Padilla. The former Secretary of State was appointed by Governor Newsom, whose vacancy was filled by Assemblymember Shirley Weber, becoming the first Black woman to serve as Secretary of State in California. Padilla, a Democrat, is California's first Latino U.S. Senator, which is the single largest ethnic group in the state. He's now representing the most diverse state in the country at a national level, and in a political field diverse in its own way and far from the Democrat majority in California politics, where he also served in the state legislature. Padilla is also on a much shorter timeline to prove that he is up to the task. An elected Senate term is 6 years. Senator Padilla has a total of just 18 months before the 2022 midterm election. I spoke with Senator Padilla back in May as he crossed his 100th day in office. You know, you've made it very clear that on the forefront of your mind is really the weight of responsibility to represent a background that is not often heard of in the United States Senate until really recent years. This Congress is the most diverse in U.S. history, but that means 11 senators are a racial or ethnic minority out of 100, so 11%. Do you feel the cards are stacked against you?
No, I don't feel like the cards are stacked against me, but it's... I certainly feel like we have a lot of work to do, and it's both the opportunity and the responsibility to bring the diverse voices of California and to represent, the diverse experiences of Californians in the deliberations of the United States Senate in a way that, hasn't been done enough of over the course of our nation's history, as you just recognized. So, I do think people are acknowledging that the nation is, more diverse by the day, not just the state of California. And so I haven't had any colleagues say, no, that's not the way it's done around here. To the contrary, a lot of colleagues saying, thank you for bringing an additional and fresher perspective. And now the challenge is how to have that reflected in legislation, right, in our work product.
The Senate is pretty much split evenly between Republicans and Democrats, and that's a starkly different negotiating field when it comes to legislation, where ideals are one thing and actually passing something is another. So how are you adapting to that learning curve?
I find myself going back to some of the basic ideas that I've leaned on throughout my public service career. When I was first elected to the city council in Los Angeles, best piece of advice I got was to sit down with each one of my new colleagues and begin to get to know each other. Maybe we agree on a lot, maybe we agree on a little bit, but in terms of working together, it begins by building those relationships. When I was elected to the state Senate, same thing. In the state Senate, unlike local government, it is partisan. There's Democrats and Republicans, but I made it a point to get to know all my colleagues. Sometimes you agree, sometimes you don't quite agree, but you're constantly looking towards not just common grounds with an individual, but building a majority vote for a bill or an initiative. Sometimes it's a different group of people that gets you the votes that you need, depending on the issue or the item. And even when I was Secretary of State in California, yes, an executive branch, but working with Republican and Democratic secretaries across the country to help modernize elections and defend voting rights. It's what got us through the 2020 election, despite the dangers of the COVID-19 pandemic. And so that's the approach I've taken here in the Senate. Active in committees already, active, in the floor of the Senate already, but making time regularly to, by phone call, by Zoom, or masked and physically distanced in offices, getting to know my colleagues on both sides of the aisle.
From the outside, California is viewed as a progressive blue state. But as you know, as Secretary of State, more California Republicans voted for President Donald Trump than any other GOP candidate in state history. There's a sizable portion of residents who feel overshadowed. Some would argue that this is leading to the recall push for Governor Newsom. Now, we know where you stand with Trump and the governor who appointed you. But what does this tell you, especially with your perspective as Secretary of State, about California voters who will ultimately decide your future as senator?
Right. Well, look, as far as my fate and my future, the best thing I can do to help make my case to the voters next year is to do the job and to do it well. So that's been my focus. As far as, you know, you said the folks who feel like they aren't as heard in the political process. It was an interesting 2020 election cycle. You're right, despite the COVID-19 pandemic, in large part because of the new policy that we put in place, making it easier for any eligible voter to register to vote, to stay registered to vote, and to cast their ballot. We saw the highest voter registration in the history of California and the highest voter turnout in the history of California on both sides of the aisle. So for anybody who thinks their voice isn't being heard, you know, step one is making sure that they can participate in the political process. And we've established that. And then second is that regardless of who the winner is in any particular election, you know, making sure that we are properly serving and are responsive to all of our constituents. And that's the approach I've always taken throughout my career in public service at the municipal level, the state level, and now as a senator.
During one of your Senate speeches, you said that we need to bring humanity to our immigration system. We know that this is deeply personal to you. Like many, you have lived those experiences. Immigration is also an issue that goes beyond a single president. There's criticism to both major political parties spanning decades. So with that in mind, why has humanity been missing in this process?
Well, I think humanity specifically is, well, especially addressed at what we've seen the last 4 years. Just to be as honest as I can be, the Trump administration wasn't just bad on immigration policy. It was, frankly, very cruel. And so credit to the Biden administration. They're setting a different tone. They repealed some of the Trump executive orders. But now Congress needs to advance a comprehensive series of reforms, you know, restoring the asylum system in a way that's smart, frankly, bringing justice in the form of security and a pathway to citizenship for so many immigrants that have been living here in the United States of America, working, paying taxes, contributing to the success of the nation, and no state more so than right here in the state of California. We're not just the most populous and diverse state in the nation. We're home to more immigrants than any state in the nation. And by the way, we are the largest economy of any state in the nation, and that's not a coincidence. You know, the contributions of the immigrant community is a big part of California's strength. And so, yes, I'm very passionate because it's important for California to help Dreamers, help folks that are here with, TPS security. And, the first bill I introduced as a senator, I think, is also a reflection of that as well. The first bill I've introduced as a senator would offer security and a pathway for citizenship to people who have been working as essential workers throughout the pandemic. You know, consider this, you know, of all the tweets and Facebook posts that we've seen praising essential workers, frontline workers in healthcare, in agriculture, in construction, in food processing, and more, you know, for their service, for their sacrifice during the pandemic to keep the economy moving and keep the rest of the community safe. People are shocked when they learn that there's more than 5 million, not just immigrant, but undocumented immigrants working as federally recognized essential workers. We can't in good conscience count on them in the middle of a crisis and praise them for their service and then turn our backs on them as the pandemic is, hopefully coming to an end here.
Some criticize you're focusing so much on immigration instead of focusing on how to help those in the country that are in need of assistance. Homelessness is a main priority in California, a huge issue. How do you plan to help those constituents who need support to get through the rest of the pandemic or just frankly get a roof over their head?
Yeah, look, it's not an either or. And in many cases, it's one and the same. So, yes, I have been vocal about wanting to better support immigrant families and immigrant communities in California. Guess what? They're my constituents, too. Many naturalized immigrants that are now citizens, many legal permanent residents that have been in California for years and years, and yes, many undocumented immigrants in California that are nonetheless raising families, working, paying taxes, and contributing. Every resident of California deserves the constituent services and support, resources, and representation from me as their United States Senator. But that's not in lieu of other priorities, whether it's helping people access their Medicare benefits or obtain their passport, or assisting veterans with much-needed health care that they've earned and deserve. Our constituent service operation has been busy since day one, and my job is, again, to be the best senator I can be for all Californians.
Well, as our conversation is kind of coming to a close, as Secretary of State, you know that no party preference is the fastest growing electorate here in California. So what do you say to Californians who want more diverse views beyond party loyalty?
Yeah, it's like that's the beauty of our democracy. As every eligible voter in California, you have the right to easily be able to register to vote and cast your ballot in every election and have your voice heard. The true test of our democracy is not just how many people showed up on election day, but what happens in between elections. We all have to stay engaged in the process, whether it's, coming to City Hall to testify for and against the city budget or a proposed development in the city or in your community. Engaging with your legislators to, raise issues that are important to you and may not be reflected in their legislative agenda. And, same with federal officials.
That is Senator Alex Padilla. Our conversation aired back in May as he crossed his 100th day in office. Up next, a difficult but important conversation about the media attention surrounding Gabby Petito. Plus, we listen and learn about Two-Spirit members within Indigenous communities. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. We're revisiting a conversation earlier this year that discusses difficult topics surrounding violence against women. This might not be suitable for everyone. The name Gabby Petito dominated headlines in online search engines. A 22-year-old traveling cross-country with her fiancé goes missing. Her body found near a Wyoming campground. And a manhunt for her boyfriend lasted for weeks, until his body was found in a Florida park, ruled a suicide. Gabby Petito is more than a name. She was a human being, a victim of homicide, a young life deserving more than her final moments. But the national attention also raised an uncomfortable yet familiar reminder. Across the country are similar horrific cases involving other women, other human beings, whose names are largely unknown. What if the same attention was devoted to the human rights crisis of missing and murdered Indigenous women, or, more broadly, women of color, or within the LGBTQ+ community? These are more than hypotheticals. They take a hard look at society's expectations of what a victim looks like, the harm that causes, and the work that still needs to be done to solve these heinous crimes. Back in September, I spoke with Britta Guerrero with the Sacramento Native American Health Center, who is a member of the San Carlos Apache tribe. Also with Zoe Flowers with the California Partnership to End Domestic Violence. You know, first and foremost, just acknowledging the life of a woman, of Gabby Petito, and without diminishing that loss and the homicide investigation, I do want to ask you both, through the lens of supporting the Native American community and women of color, how have you viewed the coverage of Gabby Petito? Britta, I'll start with you.
Sure. I think, first, I want to definitely express my sincerest condolences to the Petito family and all victims of violence. We stand with them in their grief and their quest for justice. And I think when we saw that Gabby was missing as a Native person, I think what we've seen historically in our community and that we're not unique in this, and like many communities of color, that we have been touched personally by someone who has been the victim of violence or has gone missing. And it's not 9 degrees of separation. Our families and our communities know firsthand of a situation that's taken place and the lack of media and police response to that loss or to that missing person's report. So I think, there's definitely a discrepancy that's noticeable, and I wonder what it would take to value Native women, girls, and two-spirited individuals in the same way we value the lives of white women. And I feel like it's a resounding pain that we experience knowing that we are less than, and that we're still suffering from systematic bias, institutional and structural racism, the vilifying and placement of blame on victims and their families when one of us goes missing as if we contributed to our own victimization.
Zoe, how have you viewed the coverage?
Sure. So thank you for having me, first of all. I viewed this coverage the same way that I view all of these cases in terms of the discrepancy between the media attention and the media attention that happens to, you know, Black girls, brown girls, and our Indigenous siblings, right? Just like Britta said, of course, extending, you know, my sense of grief for Gabby's family and the justice that they deserve. And also at the same time, and not taking away from that at all, but when I think about the way she was humanized, and I think this is one of the reasons why this happens, is the othering that happens to communities of color. You know, we are dehumanized in so many ways. We are othered in so many ways. We are not seen as victims for the most part. People don't think Black women, you know, can be victims because of the stereotypes and things like that. So when we go missing or when we're killed, there's no attention. And it's also looked at as our communities are violent anyway. So of course things are going to happen to them. What could you expect? Their communities are violent anyway, right? Black women are loud and aggressive. So you know, that's the mythology. So when things happen to us, there is very little attention paid.
Yeah, the late journalist Gwen Ifill, she summed it up in her own words back in 2004. She was talking at this convention called Unity, and it's a convention for journalists of color. And I'm going to play a clip. She's responding to CNN White House correspondent Suzanne Malvo. And this starts with Suzanne with Gwen responding.
Paying attention to other things and not necessarily focusing on these type of things that need immediate attention. I think at the time when 94 in Rwanda, we were looking at, you know, Nancy Kerrigan and Tonya Harding and Wayne Bobbitt. You know, everybody knows what happened to Bobbitt.
I call it the missing white woman syndrome. If there's a missing white woman, we're going to cover that every day.
Now, that was nearly 20 years ago, and this was in the context of discussing the media and national security. But I'm curious, how does this resonate with you today? Zoe, I'll start with you.
I mean, nothing's changed. I mean, we have a whole network dedicated to the missing white woman syndrome, right? And so I think that folks are just primed to be concerned about white people's issues as a whole. I mean, this is an impact. This is the impact of colonization. Who's valued? We live in a hierarchical society. And so we have white cis males, right? Primarily, you know, Christian leaning at the top. And then white women are right there. And then everybody else falls underneath. And so when the dominant culture gets to decide who matters and who doesn't, these are the things that happen. And I also just want to lift up the case of misogynoir. So many of us are familiar with the term misogyny, right? But misogynoir is a very specific type of misogyny directed at Black women in particular. And this was a phrase that was coined by Moya Bailey to really talk about what happened in pop culture. You know, the way that Black women are depicted in pop culture. But I sort of expanded it to look at, you know, Black women are not really expected or allowed to express the full range of emotion. So if we're passionate, we are threatening or angry. If we stick up for ourselves, we're angry. If we cry in public, we're weak, right? So we are just not allowed to express the full range of emotion. So again, I'm just gonna keep going back to this dehumanization, and our pain is looked at as entertainment, right? So if you can dehumanize a person, you can do anything to them.
Britta, I mean, when you and I were chatting yesterday, I mean, you brought up a very good point of, you know, judging by the lowest point in their life. And I think in that context, how does that sound that we played nearly 20 years ago resonate with you today?
Well, I think this is a literal how-to for perpetrators and predators. It's a question, I think, that they are able to ask themselves, like, how does one potentially get away with murder? They seek a victim that no one is going to look for. So they're a person of color. They are potentially a sex worker. Maybe they have a substance abuse issue. And so we look at people at the lowest point in their lives, and they may be struggling, and we say, no, it's not important. They get what they deserve. And it's a value that we continue to look at, where in the cases of these women who have gone who have gotten national recognition and national attention, they're traditionally young, conventionally attractive by Western standard. They're white, and they're often seen as fragile or privileged. And we are not, as women of color, viewed through the same lens. I said that we are looked at as though we've contributed to our own demise, like we had it coming because we put ourselves in harm's way just by being in the world. And that's become an acceptable standard by which we're measured. And to think that a woman only matters if we assign value to her as a mother or a sister or a daughter, instead of as her individual life having meaning and potential, we're not going to ever get the attention that we deserve in our communities. Homicide is the third leading cause of death amongst Native American women. This is a national emergency, and we're not responding to it. And if we continue to look the other way, the implications in our communities are absolutely critical.
Zoe, when looking at domestic violence and what your organization focuses on, I mean, you also brought up when I was talking to you yesterday about how, you know, there's actually an exploitation in all of this. I mean, there's Lifetime movies, there's actually like shows and programs that you can watch when it comes to the real life heinous crimes that are done to women.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. It's trauma porn. You know, that's what we call it. And the reality is, you know, right now there's 100,000 missing Black girls Black women and girls in this country, and nobody is talking about it. And listen, you named it, Vicky. I wasn't going to name it. I said a channel. you just went out and full on named it. But
and it's other channels as well. But it is. There are crime channels and that are devoted to this, and they do get a lot of ratings and even movies as well, especially when talking about human trafficking.
Absolutely. And even when we talk about human trafficking, again, who is looked at as being trafficked, right? Again, we have whole movies about, you know, young white girls being trafficked. And, you know, I think I shared with you last night, there's a huge trafficking problem of Black girls in Atlanta, in Florida, and nobody is talking about it.
Britta, what conversations have you had with your own family when it comes to, because what we're talking about is invisibility, you know, and how that actually contributes to the fact or the fear that no one is going to look for some people because of this invisibility and because of this view and this kind of value system of what a victim is?
Well, I think there's kind of two components that I want to bring or shine light on. And the first is that had police responded to a domestic disturbance between two people of color, there would have been an arrest made. That is not the case in this situation, where the perpetrator was cisgender, heterosexual, white, a person of privilege. They were taken to a hotel where they were separated overnight. That doesn't happen in our community. Second, so even when we don't do things wrong, we're arrested. The second piece of this is that as women of color, we're asking for it. We're sexualized, we're looked at as exotic, and we're looked at in ways that we must be wanting this male gaze, and that we are supposed to be flattered and we're supposed to feel good about getting male attention. And so we're taught to not stick up for ourselves. And so it's one of those things where this long-term blatant disrespect has become acceptable. And as parents and as women, we have to teach our sons that if you don't treat women appropriately, you should expect to be corrected, and that you will be potentially shamed for that type of behavior. And it's become absolutely acceptable. In this same case, as the perpetrator of Miss Petito, it was a boys will be boys situation. And we're dealing with two issues here that have gone, you know, on and become acceptable and become the norm in communities of color, where we expect to be victims of violence. 7 times out of 10, it's by someone outside of our communities, usually someone who's Caucasian. And if we don't respond appropriately to unwanted comments or unwanted attention, we can also become the victim of violence. So we're supposed to be flattered, and this is okay. We have to do something different.
Zoe, I want to end with you. I mean, we can take up the whole hour on this, but just I see you nodding along with Britta, and I want to give you an opportunity to share as well.
I mean, Britta's absolutely 100% correct. And one of the things is we know that society transmits culture, and we also as women identified people transmit culture as well. So we do have to look at how we are training and, you know, socializing our children, right? To make sure that the equality is there. I mean, when I think about, you know, the way that, you know, children are almost taught to ignore red flags, right? If you have a person in your family who you don't want to be around, right? Or you know that there's this uncle that is dangerous. So often in the Black community, you know, the little girl is called fast, right? But the uncle is still allowed to come around. So also as a community, we really have to do better about protecting our children. We say, right, what about the children? It's always, what about the children? What about the children? But do we really care about the children? Do we really care about the children? Right? As a society. So we really have to do better about that.
That is Zoe Flowers with the California Partnership to End Domestic Violence and Britta Guerrero with the Sacramento Native American Health Center. Our conversation aired back in September. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. If you're just joining us, we're revisiting Insight interviews this year. On October 11th, a controversial day long known as Columbus Day, we spent the entire show listening to Native and Indigenous communities throughout Sacramento. We spent time learning about an important Indigenous designation within the LGBTQ+ community. Two-Spirit, broadly speaking, defines a tribal member considered neither man nor woman, but combines activities of both men and women and occupies a distinct alternative gender status. And I say broadly speaking because, as we're about to learn, Two-Spirit is far from a monolith within tribal communities. To help us better understand, I spoke with Carl Colgrove, a member of the Hoopa Valley Tribe and the first Native American board member with the Sacramento LGBT Community Center. The Hoopa Valley Tribe is located in Humboldt County, and you have such an interesting perspective and experience. Would you mind sharing that a little bit?
Sure. So my entire family is from Hoopa, back up in the mountains. I come from two large families, two of the largest families in Hoopa, and I have countless relations, cousins, aunties, and uncles. And when I was born, my parents followed the lumber industry up to Oregon. And so I spent the first part of my youth living in Oregon in a very small lumber community. And it wasn't until later on when that industry took a turn for the worse that my parents ended up moving back to the reservation and we lived with family. So I feel really fortunate to have kind of walked in both spaces and seen two different perspectives of what it means to be an Indigenous person and in the world today.
You know, having grown up in Oregon and moving to the reservation from, you said, 15 to 26 when we chatted, so about nearly a decade, how did this shape the way you see the world?
I think that I can share, well, when I was younger, I grew up in a very dominantly white community, and I was bullied all through grade school and in middle school. And there were two things that set me apart from everybody else. One was the color of my skin. I was very brown. I was probably one of the only brown kids in my school district. And there was all kinds of terms thrown my way. And the other was I was a very effeminate young boy. And so I always got teased because of that. And so growing up, you know, I always just wanted to be like everybody else. I hated the color of my skin. I wanted to be white so bad. I wanted to just fit in with everybody else. And I knew that when I had this fear of when we were to go back to the reservation, I thought, oh my gosh, if I'm being bullied now because of this, because of the color of my skin, because who I am and how I present myself, I can't imagine how much I'll be bullied and how much worse it's going to be for me on the reservation, because we're taught that our communities are so rough and hard knock. And but when I got to the res, it was not the case. It was actually totally the opposite. I was welcomed. And so it really kind of changed my skew about Native communities. And I learned a lot of important things about who we are as Indigenous people and what is really important to us. So I hope that provides a little insight.
It certainly does. When did you come to learn about Two-Spirit and what it means?
Sure. It wasn't until fairly recently, I would say probably within the last 6 years, that I really started hearing the term Two-Spirit being thrown around. And I currently work for the Sacramento Native American Health Center. And in this space, we've brought some presenters through at times to present these ideas and talk about it. And so as I understand and have been taught over the last 6 years, that the Two-Spirit is really a contemporary term used by Native Indigenous folks with traditional and cultural understandings of gender roles and identity. So the term, as I've been told, comes from the Anishinaabe language, meaning they both have a male spirit and a female spirit in the same body. So looking back traditionally, before contact, before Columbus, before the gold rush, all these different things that have happened in on Native land. Indigenous Two-Spirit people were male, female, intersexed individuals among many other genders across all these different nations who could move between various roles assigned to, quote unquote, gender within their communities. And in many cases, these folks were regarded and very highly regarded and held very sacred roles within their communities and different duties.
How does Two-Spirit resonate with you?
For me, I had to really think about it. The goal of Two-Spirit, as I understood it, it could be used as two things, not so much a designation as it is, A, it's a collective organizing tool to kind of call out all of these, I guess, queer Indigenous folks from different communities that have these diverse sexualities, genders, and gender expressions, to kind of gather and start the conversation of who are we as queer Indigenous folks and what were our sacred roles. And it really directs you to go back to your communities and ask those questions of your own communities, because there's 574 tribes in the United States, 100 of them, 109 in the California alone. And so over all of these different nations and communities, Two-Spirit really has its own unique meaning for each one of these individuals' communities. And so the real movement of the Two-Spirit theory is to not just stop at identifying as Two-Spirit being, because it's certainly not just an LGBTQ Indigenous person. It embodies so much more. And so when I was thinking about, well, what does that term mean to me? I reached out to my cousin and I said, you know, I'm hearing this term a lot and I really want to know, like, what is HOOPA? What do our people say about that? And what are our words? I know there's over 130 terms across all these different communities for what a Two-Spirit person is in their own language. And I wanted to know what ours was. And so through the chain of cousins, I got this really important lesson that came back to me. And what was explained to me that in the HOOPA language, we didn't have terms for Two-Spirit people. We didn't even have terms for man, woman. We classified our folks by age group. So you were either an adult person, you're a young person, or you're an elder or a non-human being. And amongst those, it wasn't so much like who you were or how we referred to you. It was more like what you did in your communities. And so as a Two-Spirit person in today's society, if I were to go home, you know, I always thought, you know, growing up, I always knew, like, I was always teased. You're so effeminate. You're so effeminate. And so in the language, in the traditional language, the closest word for woman would be to, the translation means the one that ties on the dress. And so they might say of an effeminate man that they're somesalon, which means to tie on the dress. So a man who may present a little effeminately would be somesalon adone, which would be he may present or act or prefer to do like the things that women do. And then even a step further, so if a person were to train themselves to become a woman, I think if we were to equate that today to transition, they would say that they were somislan adultwe, which means to train to become a woman. And that person would live their life as a woman in community. Alternatively, there's other terms too for, there's hoestai adone, which would be more of a masculine woman assigned at birth. And then hoestai adultwe, which would be a woman who's training to be a man and live their life as a man in society. And so hearing that, you know, at first I was a little bummed because, you know, I hear all of these wonderful stories and all these other cultures across the United States where these Two-Spirit folks are really highly revered and they're matchmakers and they're medicine people and they have these really special places in their communities. And the idea is to really go back to those and be recognized among your communities. But for me, it really held a special lesson because growing up, I had always just wanted to be like everybody else. And so for me, hearing that lesson really drove that message home that, you know, back home, even though I am different inside and I always felt different, the lesson was really like, you're no different from anybody else. And we don't separate you. You know, I think in today's society, we have to put everybody in these categories. And I think for me, that was really the lesson of how special the Two-Spirit identity and movement is. You know, in the LGBT community, we talk a lot about coming out, but with Two-Spirit, I think the emphasis isn't so much about coming out as it is more about coming home.
That is Carl Colgrove, a member of the Hoopa Valley Tribe and the first Native American board member with the Sacramento LGBT Community Center, discussing Two-Spirit members within Indigenous communities. That conversation aired on Indigenous Peoples Day, October 11th. Still ahead, music did not disappoint this year. Cap Radio's Gary Vercelli selects his favorite jazz releases of 2021. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. A bright spot to 2021, creativity continued and music did not disappoint. Lucky for us, artists were hitting the studio and putting their souls into their work. Today, we're going to take a look at some of the best jazz music of the year. Gary Vercelli has been the keeper of Cap Radio's database of holiday jazz music for many, many years, and he's here to share a mixtape of the best tunes of 2021. Gary, thanks for being here.
Great to be with you.
You had the arduous assignment of narrowing your selection to your top five. What was it like parsing down from hundreds or even thousands of songs that have been released this year to just five?
Pretty easy. It's kind of like looking at a row of trees and one is just more robust than the rest. So I think we've picked out five that'll be pleasing to our audience. And they got a lot of spins on Cap Radio music.
Great. Well, happy to dive into them. First up, we have Veronica Swift with Getting to Know You. What can you tell us about this song?
She's a pretty amazing vocalist. I was back in New York at a jazz convention 5 years ago. And I was invited to hear the Jazz at Lincoln Center Orchestra in a dress rehearsal. Since it was a dress rehearsal, I was just kind of relaxing in the audience, checking my emails and stuff. And all of a sudden, I heard this voice, and I think Veronica was about 23 years old. And I don't think there's a better voice that ties the past of jazz to the future of jazz than Veronica Swift.
Get to know you, get to feel free and easy. When I am with you, getting to know what to say. Haven't you noticed? Suddenly I'm bright and breezy because of all those beautiful and new things I'm learning about you.
I can definitely get that feeling of a bridging between two different generations of jazz. That must have been such a treat for you to kind of stumble into that and be surprised by Veronica.
Yeah, and then recently she played at Mondavi, and she was very appealing there, too. She has a lot of showbiz influence in her presentation, but is really well-accredited as a jazz vocalist.
Up next, we have Mike Ladone, Rock With You. What led you to select this song?
Mike Ladone is skilled not only as a pianist, but as a master of the Hammond B3 organ. And like Veronica, he's well aware of the jazz masters that have come before him, including Barry Harris and Jimmy Smith. but he looks toward the future, and I think he's taken this song that was popularized by Michael Jackson and really given it kind of a jazz twist here.
Oh, yeah, you can definitely dance to that one.
He can cook.
He can cook. I love that. Now we actually have some Latin jazz. What can you tell us about Ray Oviedo?
Ray Oviedo is one of the legendary musicians from the Bay Area. We've had him up here in Sacramento for several concerts sponsored by the station over the years, and he's really dependable. Every time he comes up, it's like with a different nomenclature, different group of musicians. But this finds him in the Latin jazz mode, and it's a Gerald Wilson composition that was originally recorded as a big band, and then El Chicano did it in a smaller group context in the 70s, and they had a big top 40 hit with it. This is a cha-cha-cha called Viva Tirado.
Gary, I can envision you getting your steps in the booth. Do you ever get up and do a little cha-cha?
I took salsa lessons, and the teacher told me, you have an amazing sense of rhythm. It's too bad you can't remember the patterns.
Yeah. So now you just enjoy it. You enjoy the music.
I just nod my head.
Yeah. I'm sure you do that plenty when listening to this music. The next song is Mindful Moments from Alexa Tarantino.
Alexa's a great musician. She plays saxophone beautifully. She's, I think, the newest member of the Jazz at Lincoln Center Orchestra, and they've been pretty male-dominated all these years, so it's good to see some female representation. They're coming to Mondavi in early February, by the way. And Alexa here is doubling. She plays flute as well. This is kind of a mellow composition called Mindful Moments.
Yeah, there's really kind of like a lightness to it. And that's really cool. She's going to be here in February of 2022.
Yes.
So you can take her in live. Finally, we have Lewis Hayes with Arab Arab.
Lewis Hayes was born in Detroit, and he first came to New York when he was only 19 years old to join Horace Silver's band. He's worked with Cannonball Adderley, Oscar Peterson, Dexter Gordon, Kenny Burrell, all the greats in jazz. And he's also put out several albums under his own name, in a kind of a quintet setting. This is a Joe Farrell composition called Arab Arab. Thank you.
thank you for curating such a nice wide spectrum of jazz. Do you have a favorite of the five?
Well, I wanted to finish there with something strong, straight ahead, and I really like that last composition, especially with the vibes in there. Great player on vibes there.
Yeah.
And so I would say that's it, straight ahead.
That's
slow
your
traffic.
Top.
Slow traffic to the right.
Slow traffic to the right. Any upcoming releases next year in 2022 that you're eyeing?
Oh, good question. You know, it kind of slows down in December, but I think my mailbox will be pretty full in January. So I'm just urging the people to tune in to 88.9 at 7 o'clock and see what we have in store for them.
Gary, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
It really was a treat. That is Cap Radio's jazz music director, Gary Vercelli. That is it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Thank you to producers Cynthia Lopez and Nick Dobis, with managing editor Aram Sarkissian. Our digital team, Chris Hagen, Emily Zentner, Helga Salinas, and Megan Minata. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones, and our engineer, Antonio Muniz. Joe Barr is Cap Radio's chief content officer. And I'm Vicki Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. We'll catch you back here tomorrow. In the meantime, here's Veronica Swift's Getting to Know You.
Get to know all those new things day by day.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.